Welcome.
I'm Graham, if you don't know me. And I was asked to do this session on Bible translation. And the reason is not because I am a great expert in Bible translation. The reason is I'm a sort of well-read amateur. So just to get my credentials out in front, I do read Greek and Hebrew, but nowhere near as well as lots of people. I'm very glad Dirk is here. I'll point to Dirk. Now, Dirk, wave a hand. Thank you. Because Dirk reads those languages far better than I do. What I have done is ended up following quite a lot of this debate about Bible translation and doing a lot of reading of the philosophies and principles, and then I've done a little bit of teaching on that in different settings. So I'm not putting myself forward as an expert translator, but someone who's fairly well read on the issues. So that's where I'm coming from. And if people have particular questions relating to really technical stuff, Dirk maybe will chip in. And Rob here brought his laptop, and so it looks slightly daunting already. Rob has done a huge amount of statistical analysis, as well as reading around the topic, I know, Rob, because of his abilities with a computer, has compared things like the old NIV with the new NIV and that sort of thing really helpfully. And so Rob's got lots of kind of information. So we've got at least two experts of different sorts in the room, as well as me. And I'm very conscious it's one of those topics where if you're fairly well read on it, you might have come with really specific questions. And if you're not very well read on it, you might just think, oh, that was interesting, I think I'll go to that session. And you're now feeling a bit worried about what you might have to sit through. So I'm conscious there'll be a great breadth here, and I want it to be helpful for everybody, but allow the opportunity for questions on anything. So that's where I'm kind of coming from and how I'm going to approach it. Why don't I pray, and then we'll kick off and I'll tell you how we're going to do it. Let's pray. Father God, thank you for this chance to discuss such an important issue of translating your word. And it's important because your word is so important and so precious to us. We thank you that you are a speaking God. We pray you'd help us and give us insight into the different issues involved. You'd give us wisdom. You'd help us listen to each other, learn from each other. And we pray we'd finish this session encouraged and equipped in knowing what to think about this issue, but also about how to handle your word and confidence in reading it for ourselves and teaching it to others. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, you should have a handout. And what I'd like to do is just begin with a couple of historical quotes for you, just to give a bit of perspective. So William Tyndale was the guy who first translated the Bible from original Greek and Hebrew into English. Other people have done it from things like the Latin before, but he did it from the Greek and the Hebrew. And he was talking to a Church of England minister and said, "I defy the Pope and all his laws." The Church of England was still kind of Catholic authorities over it. "If God spare my life, many years I will cause a boy that driveth the plough shall know more of the scripture than thou dost." So the boy driving the plough can know the scriptures better than the priest, because he can read it in his own tongue. And the reason I put that on there is that William Tyndale was martyred for his translation of the Bible into English. So he lost his life over it. Because he believed it was so important people could read the Bible in their own language rather than only the educated priests reading it in Latin, which was the case in his day. And I just thought it was really helpful to remember this is we have a real privilege in all the versions we have. We have a real privilege just having a couple of the versions we've got. And this is something that people have died over. And then something from the preface to the original King James Version. You have to run with the metaphors they're using. "Translation it is that openeth the window to let in the light. that breaketh the shell, that we may eat the kernel, that putteth aside the curtain, that we may look into the most holy place, indeed without translation into the vulgar tongue, that's the common tongue. The unlearned are but like children at Jacob's well, without a bucket or something to draw with. So this picture of the Bible being something incredibly precious, like, you know, inside the shell, or in the temple, the holy place, but a curtain in front of it, or the well, but you can't get at it. Without translation, you can't get at this precious thing. And so just realising what a wonderful thing it is that we could actually read the Bible in our own language. So we're not discussing those, I just thought those were helpful, orientating things to kick off with, and I quite like them. So let me tell you what my aims are. I would like us to appreciate the issues involved in translation more, and as a result I'd like to become more aware of those issues in reading the Bible, and then perhaps study the Bible a bit better ourselves. And because of the situation here at Eden in changing the Bible, proposed change, we'd like have a change to try it out, to know more about the new NIV that's come out. But I'm guessing some of you may have come with particular questions. So, 30 seconds to talk with your neighbour. What particular question have you come with that you'd like answered? Or what general question have you come with that you'd like answered? Just with your neighbour, just get you talking rather than hearing me all the time. Go. Okay. Questions you come with. Call someone out, or call out what your neighbour just said to you.
Issues of gender neutrality.
Sorry?
Issues of gender neutrality.
Okay. Yep, so issues of gender and how that's going to play into translation. Yep, put something on that. Okay, what else?
Literal verse interpreted, especially when the grammar of the original and the target language simply don't match.
Okay, great, thank you. Well, if you don't understand that, I'll explain that in a minute. Yeah, I'll explain that in a minute. Yeah. Other questions?
Read in a language which is familiar, either a language of an English, or in a language that we use day to day. I grew up with the authorised version with Shakespeare's English.
Yeah.
And I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with, for instance, I came here really to be informed about why we're changing.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Great. Anything else?
If we're so bothered about how we translate the Bible, why don't we just go and read the original?
I just don't want to buy it. Can I make a comment on that? I saw Julian on Sunday and remarked that he looked very tired, and he said, yes, I've been preparing the sermons on Luke, and I've been reading Luke in the Greek,
yeah.
And the chapter takes me 3 hours.
I think there's a fairly simple answer to that question, which is that learning Greek and Hebrew to the level that you can just pick up a Bible and read it easily is years of investment of time. And that just doesn't seem either reasonable or a good use of time to ask people. So I think it's important that people who study the Bible in great depth, there's, you can make a great case for their learning the original languages. But that, the idea that you just tell your whole congregation that the equipment is now going to run in Greek classes, so this and so on. So,
but I mean, the idea is that, can we agree that we have this huge debate mainly for the sake of the people who aren't even here?
How do you mean?
And like, most people, like,
we're debating this for the sake of the kind of general Christian congregation rather than people rather than for the sake of those of us who are bothered enough to be here. Mainly.
Yes and no. I think we are. We obviously have to discuss this issue for, say, Eden at large, which includes a huge variety of people. Non-Christians come, Christians, well-read, not well-read, aware of the issues, unaware of the issues. But we're also doing this for the sake of us who have particular questions. So, okay, well, we will attempt to cover those things on the way through. As I say, though, it's a slight issue in terms of judging the depth we go to, but I'll give space for questions. Let me give a little bit of history and then some recent developments which I think will help people who are just don't know that much about the whole area. I've just put a little list of abbreviations on there. Back in the 17th century, 400 years ago this year, in 1611, the King James Version came out. And it was then revised in a variety of ways. The Revised Version, the Revised Standard Version, and then the New Revised Standard Version. And that's obviously all part of the same kind of lineage, if you like. In America, it's slightly different, the American Standard Version and the New American Standard Bible. And so, many, many people were brought up either on the King James Version or some of the later descendants of it. But then in the 1960s and 70s, there's a whole variety of what I just called new translations. And these ranged from things like the Good News Bible to the work of just one individual called J.B. Phillips, who produced his own version of different of books of the New Testament. You know, here's a copy of Mark, which sounds nothing like the King James Version. It was quite groundbreaking in its day. And then in the 1970s, the NIV. And the NIV was produced because of perceived weaknesses in that list above, things like the RSV, and because these other Bibles, things like the Good News, had various weaknesses as well. I think it's fair to say, from the 1980s and 90s, there was a kind of dominance of the NIV in evangelicalism. Now, that's not globally true. Some evangelicals continue to use something like the RSV, but the NIV, most evangelical churches you walked into, there'd be an NIV widely being used. More recently, there's been what I've called a dividing of the ways. I'm not trying to create division where there isn't, but I think there has been. And I think things have gone in two directions. There has been the rise of what I've called linguistic conservatism. That is, people who've decided that things, the way the NIV has done things, this isn't the new NIV, this is the old NIV, people were too free and easy with the text. Free and easy is too strong a term. Basically, we needed something that was closer to the original, something more accurate to the original, that followed it much more tightly. Something, in fact, in the line of the King James Version that I traced above. And people in that camp would say that things like the NRSV, the New Revised Standard Version, has actually slightly betrayed their inheritance. And that's where the ESV Bible has come from, the English Standard Version. And in various magazines and publications, you'd have articles entitled things like, "Is this the Bible we've been waiting for?" So there's quite a strong sense among some people of, this is it, this is going to answer all the problems of the NIV. Now, not identical to that concern, but associated with it, is gender language. Because at the same time, the NIV grouping began to release gender-inclusive versions. There was the NIV-I, the NIV Inclusive Language Edition, and then later the TNIV, the Today's New International Version, both of which, in slightly different ways, had inclusive language on gender. And that's not the same as just this conservatism I've described, but played into it, and particularly in the States, became just an incredibly hot topic. Less so here, but in some quarters here. I think it was John Carson coined the phrase Bible rage as a sort of Bible equivalent to road rage, where people were just going kind of a bit over the top in their responses to each other. And in fact, you'd have people say things of the, say this is of the TNIV, they'd say things like, these are human words that men have substituted for the words of God. They have no place in the Bible. And then quotes Deuteronomy 4, you shall not add to the word I commanded you, nor take away from it. And that's an incredibly strong statement to make about a mainstream Bible publication. To say they're changing the Bible and adding to it. They're breaking God's laws about changing his word. And that's over gender language. So that's the sort of tone that is used. Conversely, on the other side of my dividing of the ways, there's the rise over recent years of what I've called linguistic latitude, of people being incredibly relaxed about Bible versions, and a multiplication of both more paraphrase type versions, things like The Message, for example, by Eugene Peterson. Now, Eugene Peterson never meant his version, The Message, to be used for kind of serious Bible study. It's a paraphrase. It's quite thought-provoking. It's very modern language. He wanted it to be read as a refreshing way of hearing God's word, almost as a sort of a semi-commentary, while reading a more standard translation. But then you get people turning up to a student Bible study, and they've got The Message. And the person sitting next to them has the ESV. And you wouldn't know they were reading the same book. And that's an example of this dividing of the ways. You also get the kind of personalised Bible, you know, the Spirit-filled life Bible, or the Bible for young married adults, or something. And my favourite was kind of like a Roman Catholic one, Precious Bible Moments for Babies, or something. And it was a version of the Bible, which has various articles added, and all this sort of thing.
There's a horse's Bible, isn't
there? A horse's Bible. Nice. Yeah. So you see what I mean? Just like now, the sort of individualised ones are a standard Bible translation, but with lots of articles and things to make it personalised to you and your stage of life. But there's also lots of more paraphrase type Bibles being used. So that's been the situation.
Graham, I'm not clear where the NIV then fits into this dividing of the ways.
Well, the NIV, I'm not trying to place Bible, I'm sorry, I'm placing Bible versions. I'm more placing groups of people, a group concerned for a much tighter translation philosophy, which would show itself in the ESV, and then a movement within our culture of lots and lots of different Bibles, including much more paraphrase-type Bibles. And it's not the NIV kind of maps onto it particularly, it's just that's what's happened, I think, around us. That's just the situation. Any questions on the situation? Is it happy? Turn over the page then. Let's get into the issues. Let me begin with an example, and then I'm going to kind of just one example, and then I'm going to try and detail things out a bit more fully. So let me explain the general map. What I'm going to do is to do some stuff on general translation, which I hope will take sort of about 20 minutes or half an hour or something. And within that, we can mention some things about why the new NIV, then do some stuff on gender. So I'm going to do gender language separately at the end. Okay? So let's have a look at Matthew 9:10, an innocuous little verse beginning an episode in Matthew's Gospel. And I've put down three translations there, the ESV, the NIV, and the New Living Translation. What I'd like you to do with your neighbour for a moment is just look through those, I guess guessing you're reading them as I'm speaking, look through those and just start thinking to yourself what's different about them, what changes are there? And we'll come back to which is a good one in a moment, but just what do you notice, first of all? Just with your neighbour for a moment, just quickly, what do you notice about those three different translations? Be in twos or threes or whatever's convenient. Okay. What have you noticed? Just call some things out. I've heard some good things being said. Yes? Where's that? Okay. Yes. Yep. Okay, we'll come back to that in a minute. Let's make observations first. So first of all, the first one just says the house. The later ones say Matthew's house, or mentions Matthew in particular. Okay.
The sinners in the NIV, actually, in the one that Peter's not here, it's in inverted commas as well, which is what I thought it did.
Sorry, say it again.
It actually put the word sinners in quote marks.
Okay.
And in the last one, it's added the adjective description.
Yes, great, good observation, thank you. We'll come back to that.
Reclining on the table with the only person who says.
Yes, whereas the others make it
having dinner.
Or being invited.
Yes.
The last one is much more. It's sort of a different event. He's being invited as opposed to actually sitting at the table, as in the first one.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. It's changed the perspective, hasn't it? Rather than while it was happening, he's invited him along with. So that's changed it. Yeah?
But if you invited someone home, I guess you would expect them to, in those days, recline at the table.
Well, if you know that about those days. As in, you have some pre-existing knowledge. Whereas if you were completely new to first century culture, if that's what you did in your culture, so it depends. We're all very culturally bound. So if we say dinner, we think sitting around a table, knives and forks. If you said that to somebody from the Middle East, they might picture sitting cross-legged around in a room and eating with their hands. So it depends. It all depends what you think that means. Now, literally, more literally, it simply says that Jesus reclined in the house. So you see, even the first one, the ESV, has added at table. And the reason it has is because if you simply said, as Jesus reclined in the house, and many tax collectors and sinners came and were reclining with him, what would an English person picture? Having a little sleep, or just sitting around on the sofa. They're just reclining. And what you need to know is that reclining means lying on your side at a table to eat. So there's a cultural issue that we know of from the first century, which means that translating this literally, as it were, just as literally as you can, sort of just what does that word mean, reclined, make it reclined, would actually be, at first sight, misleading. Now you could then say, well, in which case you just need to know more about the Bible times to read the Bible properly, or someone has to teach you. And that would be true, and you could then understand that when it says reclined, that doesn't mean lying around, it means eating. So that's one issue. That's why the NIV goes for having dinner. So there's no mention of reclining, but you now picture what they're doing together, which is eating something. But you would probably picture it as a table rather than lying on your side. So you've got the function right, but you've got the posture wrong. And then the New Living Translation, as you pointed out, simply says invited as dinner guests. So you picture them having dinner of some kind, but it's actually changed it slightly to this idea of inviting, rather than just saying while they were eating. Then there's the issue of tax collectors and sinners. And the NIV, I was going to check this. Many tax collectors. In the new NIV, it doesn't have the word sinners in inverted commas. The old NIV did. And that's because it was sort of a word used of another group of people. So those sinners. And everyone at the time would know, well, we mean people who aren't living obedient to the law and so on. So there's a kind of a designated group we think of as sinners. Well, if you use a word like that in your culture to refer to a designated group, but you might not actually, you know, are they actually sinners? Are they more sinners than the Pharisees are? Well, that's debatable. So why not now make it sinners? And there's something you can do in English to give that an idea. Or the New Living Translation could say disreputable sinners to give the idea of it's about their reputation. But now you're having to add a word in. Last thing to comment on is just there's one thing you didn't mention, which was there's another word in the top one, which is behold, which is translating a word that's there in the original. Jesus was eating, and behold, there were people here. Like, look. And that's something which you can do in Greek quite easily, and it's a way of kind of going, well, this is happening, and look, this is happening at the same time. That's the sense of it. It just reads really oddly in English. We don't tend to say, this was happening, and look, this is happening as well.
Like a children's book.
Exactly. Look, the cat walks in, you know. Or at least if you put it like that in English, you're now giving it much more emphasis than it would have had in Greek. As in, it wouldn't have stood out that much to someone reading Greek. So what do you do with it? You're going to put it in? Or you're going to leave it out? Because you can't have a halfway house, as it were, and saying, behold, probably is too prominent, missing it out. You missed out a word that was there in the first place. Yeah, so you could end up with some phrase at the same time or at that moment, which might try and get the feel of, look. But see, now you're not translating that the word. The word means behold or look.
Isn't that what the word while in English trying to do?
Yes, quite possibly. I don't know, but it could well be trying to capture that. While this was happening, this happened. Yeah. But I think that's probably right, that's a good observation. My point is now that if you use some other stylistic device to capture that, you're no longer translating the word in Greek into an obviously recognisable word in English, that the word look means look. You're having to do something else with it. Now, I did that with that example, so I think that illustrates loads of things. It illustrates how difficult translating one verse of the Bible is to translate it well. And the issue is, that I put on here, is how closely do you try and represent the original language given the differences there are in culture and thought patterns and syntax of language? That's the big question. When you read on this, you will be told, by and large, that there are two approaches. Dynamic equivalence and formal equivalence. And dynamic equivalence is often described as aiming at the same meaning as the original, but being less concerned about tightly following its structure or a sort of translating each word. Whereas formal equivalence is aiming at the same meaning, but is trying to get there through the same structure. So, for example, to say Jesus was having dinner, well, you haven't translated the word reclining. So that would be an example of dynamic equivalence. You've got the same meaning, because that's what reclining kind of means in that situation. Whereas if you wanted a formal equivalence, you should simply say he was reclining. Now, to say he's reclining at table, as it happens, reclining at table is a slightly odd phrase anyway. Reclining at the table or a table is a kind of halfway house, I suppose, between the two. So you see the idea of dynamic trying to capture the meaning, and the formal trying to capture the structure at the same time. Does that make sense? And there is then a kind of tension on a couple of different things I put on the handout. There's the idea of accuracy to the original, and that is, I'm going to qualify this, because I don't just mean accuracy in terms of has it... Well, we have to debate what is an accurate translation. I'm going to come back to that. But accuracy in terms of trying to get each word and the structure and so on. There's accuracy to the original versus kind of readability and naturalness, because you can end up with something quite accurate but quite wooden sounding and quite awkward. Things like the NASB, the New American Standard Bible I mentioned, if you try and read it out loud, it's actually quite difficult, because it just doesn't sound like English, because it's trying to be very tight on that sort of accuracy, but not very readable, not very natural. Well, to put it a different way, a different sort of tension, there's the priority of the original text. I'm just trying to say exactly what it said there. And then the priority of your readers. I want my readers to understand what it meant. So if I simply say reclined, they won't understand. And these are the tensions of Bible translation. So all I'm going to do is look through some more examples of those. Any further questions? Do just... We're a small group, you can just throw in questions whenever.
I was asked earlier, why does Matthew appear in the second two and not in the first one?
Thank you. I need to check the Greek, but I'm pretty sure Matthew's not there in the original, and it's simply for clarity as to where he is. What has just happened in Matthew 9 is that he has called Matthew from his booth, follow me. Matthew got up and followed him. The next verse, while Jesus reclined in the house. Whose house? Well, we know from the context it's Matthew's house, so making that clearer. In fact, the ESV has introduced the word Jesus, because Jesus isn't there either. It literally simply says, and he reclined in the house. I know, but I'm just saying these sorts of things happen all the time. So I was trying to say, don't necessarily give the NIV a hard time putting in the word Matthew. The ESV's put in the word Jesus.
Yeah.
And that's just because they took the decision to say, and he reclined in the house, was too ambiguous. In Greek, because of the way the language works, it can be much easier to follow who it is you're talking about. So Jesus was the subject of the previous verse. Jesus called Matthew. And he's in a certain case in that verse. And then it's the same case. And he, and you know that's Jesus. But in English, Jesus calls Matthew. And he, is that Jesus or Matthew?
There will be less of a problem if you translate it into, say, German.
I don't know German, but yeah. anyway, so do you see what I mean? So in English, because English isn't coded in that way, you don't know who he refers to. In Greek, you did. So you make it obvious and write the word Jesus rather than he. But this is just happening all the time, Bible translation. There's nothing wrong with it. This is all because languages work differently. And you cannot just do a word-for-word translation because it won't make any sense. So, let's think about it a bit closer. Number four, we're looking closer. Just thinking about some grammatical structural issues. Things like word order, for example. 2 Timothy 2:14, Paul says to Timothy, "These things remind them of." That would make sense if I put in more than a sentence. My point is simply that if you translated things in the order they come in the Greek, you'll end up sounding like Yoda, where you say, you know, wise you are, and so on, because the verbs come after, we would say, you are wise. So, these things remind them of become remind them of these things. That's just a silly illustration, but I don't think, the point is, you cannot follow word order easily in a translation. In German, I do know about German, you always put the verb at the end of the sentence. So, I was told that. Okay, in which case we're not going there at all. So, but the point is clear, while you might want to try and follow word order, often you just can't because it won't make sense or won't sound like English.
If you want an example like that, you can say Hungarian or Japanese.
Okay.
The
verb is
always right at the end.
Okay. Thank you. Wow. What about certain connectives? If you read the ESV, Mark's Gospel in the ESV, you'll discover the word "and" an awful lot. And Jesus went and did this, and he said that, and someone came up to him, and this. And if you read it out loud, it sounds really odd, because we don't use the word. If you wrote that in an English essay, someone would tell you off for bad style. In Greek, the word that's used and is translated "and" is very, you can use that very easily like that. And it's a bit like the word "behold" we had earlier. To translate it kind of gives it a bit too much prominence in English. It wouldn't have stood out in quite the same way. So do you translate it and have it there, or do you leave it out? Because you might feel like, oh, I must translate it because it's part of the Bible, but the fact is it would now sound slightly different to how it would have sounded to someone reading it in Greek, because it will be too prominent. Other connectives, like the word for example, are really crucial to the flow of thought in an epistle or something. And some of the looser translations, the more dynamic equivalent ones, will sometimes not translate them at times, and you think, oh, come on, we need that for the flow of argument. So some connectives are vital. Other connectives are, well, do I or don't I? Sentence length. In Greek, for example, you can have incredibly long sentences with lots of sub-clauses. In English, that just starts to become unclear. So, for example, in Ephesians 1, I think it is, which is a classic example of a really long sentence. Actually, no, I haven't got that one down. I've got Ephesians 3 down. Like one section of Ephesians 3, in the NIV, it's made into three sentences. In the ESV, it's just one sentence. Or part of Ephesians 5 is four sentences in the NIV, but in ESV, it's all in one sentence. Now, the question is, if the Greek language allows you to do that very easily and still follow what's happening, but the English language doesn't let you do that so easily, which is the better translation? Is it better to have shorter sentences which sound more like normal English and then carefully choose how the sentences are connected? So the next sentence can begin, "so then," which shows its relationship to the previous sentence. Or should it all be strung along in one long sentence? Now, I happily admit, chopping it up too much can, I think, sometimes change the flow of meaning. But it's not obvious to me that chopping it up more than it is in Greek changes the meaning. And in fact, the ESV, there are lots of sentences in Greek that are so long, even the ESV can't bear to have it that long in English, because it just wouldn't work. You just wouldn't make sense of it. So they have to chop it up in point moments as well.
What's the date of the ESV?
What's the date?
The date.
Oh, I forget. 2001?
2005.
Yeah. No, I was just thinking that if you go back...
I think it's before that, but anyway, around then.
If you go back into the 19th century, Dickens, for instance, wrote enormously long sentences, and all the writers did then.
Yeah.
And it was quite normal.
Yeah.
So this is the idea that short sentences are necessary to understanding.
Yeah.
Is a relatively recent development. Presumably, if they done the ESV in 1905, they would have translated these sentences.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And this brings us back to one of your questions at the beginning: was why ever sort of change a Bible version? And the basic answer is, well, there are several answers, but one part of it is English language changes.
Meaning changes too.
Yeah.
Sorry,
ESV is
just.
Okay.
Can I ask you a question? You've given the example of where you've got something, say, in Greek, and to translate it, in this more literal way, makes it much more difficult to read in English than it would have been for the original reader in Greek.
Mm.
But in some of the books that I've read about arguing for a very literal sort of translation, give examples of how some of the Greek texts in the Bible actually would have been difficult to read for the original reader, or they had unusual amounts of connectives or whatever in the original Greek that would have seemed odd to the original reader, and the translations like the NIV and the NLT smooth all that out, make it very easy to read.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Because that's a sort of different case. That's making it easier to read than it would have been for the original reader at some cost. Do you think that that's a reasonable thing to do?
No, I would have more concern about that. Yeah. Dirk, you know more about this than I do.
Yeah. I think that is a valid objection against almost all current translations that are on the market. We have an example from Matthew, Matthew 9:10. It's interesting. When you read it in the Greek, this verse, it very much sounds like the Greek Old Testament in its whole sentence structure, with the behold and with the way, and it came to pass when he reclined. That's the King James. It is very much kind of Old Testament Greek.
Mm.
Now that connection has been lost a little bit. Most Greeks in the first century would have picked up that there is something artificial here about the language. And if you knew your kind of Old Testament, you would pick it up, the same as we would pick up King James language. So yeah, that's a necessary sacrifice you have to make in translation. But of course, if you want to work hard on the text, because that is then, and if you are prepared to work hard on very long sentences, then go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are several issues. One is, what is the most accurate way of doing something in the sense of what will convey the sense best? And my point is, that's not always keeping to the exact structure. But keeping to the exact structure may, in many cases, be very helpful, and it could easily be that some translations try and make things too easy. And that's back to the priority of the original text versus priority of the reader's sort of tension. The last one I mentioned on here was just emphasis, and my point was just going to be that emphasis is made differently in different languages. That you put some things at the front of a sentence, or at the end of a sentence, and so on, and that varies from language to language about what sounds emphatic. So again, there might be a reason to change the sort of sentence structure. So on structure, my summary points at the bottom there with the arrows, closer structure is not always possible. It's not always desirable. but freer structure, sitting completely loose to the structure of the original, can, I should say, lose meaning, not loose meaning. So you can probably read something into that about translation if you wanted to. But freer structure can lose meaning. I've got no desire for people to sit completely loose to structure at all. So, time's moving on. We need to speed up. So, meaning of word stuff. John 2. ESV, Jesus said to her, this is John, Jesus replying to his mother at the wedding at Cana of Galilee. Woman, what does this have to do with me? The old NIV said, dear woman, why do you involve me? And the CEV says, mother, my time hasn't yet come. And my point is simply the word that is translated, woman, dear woman, and mother. If you say woman, what sort of tone do you imagine is on Jesus' lips here?
Rebuke.
Sounds a bit rebuking, doesn't it? If you say dear woman, it softens it immediately. But it could be a bit patronising, depending on how you think that's taken. And if you say mother, then you've sort of mistranslated it, because it's the word for woman. But you might have captured the sense of it better or not, depends what you think. And my point is simply that the tone and feel of a word is incredibly important, as well as what it means. It means woman. But in this instance, it doesn't imply any rebuke or harshness. And yet if you just translate it straight, as it were, in English, it does sound like it conveys harshness. The contemporary English version. I've mainly tried to use ESV, NIV and New Living, just because they're good representative ones. Occasionally I've put in a different one just because it illustrated the point.
CEV is missing an entire clause. Why do you involve me, or what does this have to do with me then? Just isn't there in the CEV.
Well, no, that's the why my time hasn't yet come. It could be that my cousin paste has gone awry, so I don't jump to terrible conclusions about the CEV yet. Yes, that's how it goes on, isn't it? Why did you involve me? My time hasn't yet come. So maybe it carried on, my time hasn't yet come, why do you involve me? So maybe they just changed it, I'm not sure. My point was about the mother. Over the page, Ruth 2. Remember the story of Ruth, and Boaz is a relative who can act as a redeemer, where he could marry Ruth and so continue on the family line. This is in something going on in the law. And so the ESV calls him a redeemer, the New NIV calls him a guardian redeemer, the old NIV called it a kinsman redeemer to get the idea of a family, but the problem is the word kinsman just isn't used today. I think that's probably wise not to continue with it. Guardian does convey the idea of a protector, and the word has that sense, which you can get from the CEV. It's one who is to look after us, which then now loses any idea of redeeming you. Now, I'm not going to argue which one's supposed to be best. My point is simply, there's a significant word in the book of Ruth, and it's really tricky to sum it up with one word in English. We just don't have a word that works. So, now this is where translations can put in footnotes and this sort of thing. And again, study Bibles and being taught it will obviously come into play. It's not that we think the Bible has to mean absolutely everything to us just on one reading. But I hope the point's clear. It's not obvious how to translate it. You can also have problems going the other way. This is where there isn't a word in the receptor language that fits the word from the initial language. What about if you're translating the word snow from Hebrew into, I forget what it's called, but languages used, you know, in the Arctic and so on, Greenland and so on, the Eskimos speak, and they'll say, but we've got about 7 words for snow. Do you mean crisp snow, dry snow, crushed snow? Because they've got lots of words for snow. Now you've got multiple words in the receptor language, where only one word in the original language. Which one works? So I'm just, my point is just, it's not always easy. Amos 8. Amos is asked a question. What do you see? I see a basket of summer fruit. This is the ESV. And that's a very good translation. It is indeed summer fruit. And then the Lord said to me, the end has come upon my people Israel. That's not a bad translation. The word end means end. The problem is that you kind of go, what's the fruit got to do with the end coming upon Israel? And the answer is that in Hebrew, the word for summer fruit sounds like the word for end. So you'd hear it and you'd go, ah, summer fruit, end. They're kind of sounding identical. And of course, summer fruit is ripe fruit. It's ready. And the idea of the end has come is that it's time. So you'd hear this similarity and you'd kind of see a similarity, which is completely lost in a more accurate translation that goes for what the words mean. The NIV says a basket of ripe fruit. Then the Lord said to me, the time is ripe. Now, this means you, as it were, mistranslated the word for summer fruit, because you made it ripe. And you've not used the word for end, you've said ripe. But you've now captured a connection between the two ideas. And the New Living Translation, a basket of ripe fruit, like this fruit, Israel is ripe for punishment. Which does the same with the NIV, but now it's spelling it out even more fully for you. Because it doesn't say, like this fruit. That's not there at all in the original. Now on that one, I would actually suggest that the NIV is probably the best translation in making a kind of connection. But it's not the more literal translation. That's the ESV. So my point in these is that more literal isn't always more accurate. But more free can start to introduce new ideas. Like the, you know, like this fruit, you've introduced a new thing, or the Ruth 2, one is to who's to look after us. It's now it's a different sort of feel to the word Redeemer, even if the word Redeemer has a sense of protection. Last bit, idiom or metaphor. Galatians 5. ESV says, walk by the Spirit, and it's the word for walking. The problem is that the word for walking in Greek there has the idea of the way you live. It's not walking down the road. Now, for many of us, that's not a problem, because we're so used to that sort of metaphor. So we're kind of Bible literate. But if you said to somebody who doesn't know nothing of the Bible, walk by the Spirit, they could easily think you mean actually physically walk somewhere by it. Because that's where we use the word walk. We don't use the word, apart from the idea of, you know, in the various walks of life or something. We don't tend to use the word walk for the way you live. So the NIV says live by the Spirit. The NLT says let the Holy Spirit guide your lives. Which is best? Amos 5, ESV, I gave you cleanness of teeth in all your cities and lack of bread in all your places. It's a literal translation. It is cleanness of teeth. But it does make it sound like God's a dental hygienist. And the idea is your teeth are clean because you've got nothing to put in your mouth. Or hence the second half, lack of bread. So the NIV says, I gave you empty stomachs in every city and lack of bread. I'm not sure if they said empty mouths. Because at least that would have, I think that would have kept the idea of nothing in your mouth. And the NLT says, I brought hunger. And loses any sort of metaphor altogether. ESV for Genesis 19 and Sodom and Gomorrah, bring them out to us that we may know them, but that's not get to know them, that's a metaphor. And so the NIV says, so that we can have sex with them. That's what they meant. So do you keep the metaphor if the metaphor doesn't work in your language? The NLT is the same. Last one, Psalm 1. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. And it's got this walking, standing, sitting. It's kind of idiomatic. And you walk in their counsel, in the way, and in the sit in the seat. The problem is, standing in the way of sinners sounds like you're blocking their path. And that might be a good thing. So the NIV, new one, says, this is the 2011, blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked, stand in the way that sinners take, or sit in the company of mockers. Now, they have kept the walk, stand, and sit, but they've modified them to make it clear what they meant, what they mean. The NLT says, the joys of those who do not follow the advice, or stand around with sinners, or join in with mockers. And now the stand, walk, sit has gone completely. And my point in these is that more literal, again, is not always helpful in translating metaphors. And it's worth just knowing, things like the ESV that are a more literal translation, there are countless metaphors and idioms that they don't translate literally because it just doesn't work. It just doesn't make sense in English. So they have to give the meaning of the metaphor. So something like Isaiah 40, I think it is, it's literally speak to the heart of Jerusalem. And in English, it's what does it mean to speak to the heart? And it's a metaphor or an idiom for speaking tenderly. So I think the ESV says something about speaking tenderly. So more literal isn't always most helpful, but more free can lose significant details. Like the stand, you know, walk, stand, sit, I think is there, and that's lost in the NLT. Or the whole let the Holy Spirit guide your lives might give quite a different feel to walk by or live by. So here's my summary on all this, how we go about translating. It's not written down, don't turn to the page. It's just my summary. The whole diverging of the ways thing, more conservative, more free, I think that is a concern for us. Particularly the more free things, if our Bible reading is all with freer translations, there are lots of details we will miss. I think those translations can have a place in helping us read a Bible passage that we might be very familiar with and be struck by, oh, that sounds interesting. You go, oh, the joys of, rather than blessed is. But as I'm struck by something, I must want to go back to a tighter translation and think, is that really what it says? Because I know that this looser one could be more misleading. So I'm not saying there isn't a place for them, but it's a very carefully circumscribed place. With things like the ESV versus the NIV, well, I think there are lots of places where the ESV is more accurate in trying to capture the sense and meaning than the NIV is. I also think there are places where the NIV is more accurate in capturing sense and meaning than the ESV is. And the reason is because more literal isn't always more accurate. Because of the way different languages work and are structured. And then when you put that together with issues of readability, I would argue that for the general congregational use, the NIV really has the edge over things like the ESV, which is actually much harder to read and make sense of. And some of the language choices, I think, are expecting people to know biblical terminology and use slightly old language and that sort of thing. I'm not trying to promote NIV over ESV, I'm just trying to illustrate and give a bit of a feel for these things. The reason newer translations like ESV and the new NIV are needed is because language changes, and lots of things that are in the old NIV simply don't make sense anymore, or could be put much better. There are also advances in scholarship where certain verses are better understood and that sort of thing, but primarily, as far as I'm concerned, it's about changes in language. So to say that Mary was found to be with child, you know, if you're familiar with the Bible reading at Christmas, that doesn't strike you as odd at all. But if your neighbour said, "My daughter's found to be with child," you'd think, "What? Where have you just come from? You mean she's pregnant?" And this is an example of how language has changed. And in the Bible, we can easily think, "Oh, that's just what it says." But actually, there are much more contemporary ways of putting it. Okay, there's some general stuff on translation. We'll do gender next. But general, any questions on what we've done?
Just before we move on, has the language changed that much since the 70s and the 80s when the NIV was there?
Has it changed that much? Well, I've not done lots of reading on that sort of area, so this is rather impressionistic. It clearly hasn't changed so much as to make reading the 1984 NIV a big, big problem for many, many passages. So someone who doesn't know the Bible well, doesn't know Bible language and so on, reading the 1984 NIV, I think lots of it they'd understand perfectly well. But there would be a whole number of passages where it would either be strike them as odd, like the word, you know, the Gentiles are granted repentance unto life. Well, we don't use the word unto anymore, like that. That's kind of Bible, that's biblish. You know, we kind of get this whole little language. I heard someone use the phrase unto, the word unto, in a prayer recently. But it's like, well, that's because you read the Bible a lot and you use those sorts of terms. But in general English, you don't use that word. And you could go on with lots of little examples like that. The word alien, as in alien and stranger, now means an extraterrestrial. But that's not what it meant in the 70s. It was a sort of a foreigner. So, you know, there are lots and lots of examples where it does make a difference. Whether there's enough of a difference to have justified a new translation, I'm not in a position to judge that. And to a certain extent, it's impossible that they would do so or try to do so, because words like wicked, like that, in a certain subculture,
yeah,
by the time you'd actually produce the translation, it would be out of date.
And also, do we, for words like that, there's a question for us as Christians to ask is, do we want to change the definition of wicked,
yeah,
from our point of view, yeah, from bad to good?
Yes, but in some instances, if a word does change, like the word alien changes,
yes.
Well, if you can pick another word, there's no need to defend the word alien. Mm-hmm. I'd defend the word wicked. If the word evil would do instead, that would be fine. Yeah, so it doesn't. In one sense, we're not after protecting certain words, although there might be particular words that have particular theological importance we want to defend. But yes, language changes very quickly in subcultures. What you have to do for a more general translation is ask about a much larger culture and over a longer period of time, and then say, has it changed enough and is it stable enough to actually produce something that would be helpful?
May I give examples about, like, maybe because the Bible has so much influence on our language that in some cases the Bible changed our language so much that the Bible itself in newer translations has to move away from it. For example, English Bibles are, I think, one of the very few languages, if not the only one, who has actually moved away from the literal currency unit talent because it's used metaphorically in English so prevalently.
There's been some interesting articles because of the KJV's 400th anniversary about how the KJV had introduced certain phrases and terms and ways of putting things that weren't common in English.
Yeah.
But it become common, and how it's influenced the English language as a result.
Yeah.
With the new translation, because they try to make it as easy to read, the NIV type translation tries to make it as easy to read as possible, that isn't going to happen.
Yes, I think that's right. And I've read similar things about the way the King James actually introduced terms. There are several issues wrapped up in that, and not least is the fact that when you were in a country where everybody went to church and heard the same Bible read, you could influence the language. Whereas if we introduced new terms into, say, the NIV and said, well, that's a great term to express that idea biblically, that'll influence the language, it just won't. Because there's not enough, it doesn't get enough airtime within the population as a whole. Whereas if everybody in the country was in church and heard the Bible read on Sunday, week in, week out, people start to hear the same phrases, they start to use them. My point is simply, there's been a huge cultural change as to the airtime the Bible gets, and therefore I just don't think we have to accept that's not going to happen.
I don't think it's just about airtime. I think there is one of the issues I find with, I have my computer here because I have like 14 translations and a program on it to look at. I use all these translations, but it's almost like there's something lost in some of the translations, like the NIV, that you don't appreciate that it is an ancient document. Often that is lost, and so you read it like you'd read anything else, and it doesn't. I find some of the things don't have the same impact on you that they would when you read it in these more difficult to read translations.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something depending on the purpose that you're reading it for. I mean, if you wanted to really study, you could use an older version. But if you wanted to actually, think about how to live, start thinking about it, understand it, you probably should use it.
Well, let me comment on both those things, and we're going to have to move on because I don't want this to run on for ages. Does it sound like an ancient document?
Well, it's not just does it sound like that. Is a reader aware? I've spoken to people. In fact, I've had a discussion with any big translators about this, and the extent to which the new NIV goes to almost hide the fact that Things were different in those days.
Yeah.
I think can be quite misleading to the reader.
Yeah, and I do have sympathy with that. What, to put it rather simplistically, what we're after is linguistic translation, so you understand the words, not cultural translation. So if you make, Paul says, greet one another with a holy kiss, J.B. Phillips, I think, made it, hearty handshakes all round or something. But that's cultural translation, not linguistic. Because we understand what the word kiss and the word holy and so on. So, now, as with the example of reclining in the house illustrates, the two do touch each other. Because you have to say, if I'm just going to translate it linguistically, I use the word reclined. And then you don't know what I mean, I know you know what I mean, but that's what all I'm doing. You have to find out what that means.
Well, let me give you another example. What about this example I've got in my paper? There's a passage in the Old Testament, and it says something like, your soldiers are all women.
Yes.
But in the new NIV, they put your soldiers are all weaklings.
Yeah.
And the NIV translator says, the reason for that is that soldiers today are women as well as men. So, you know, but the fact is that those days they weren't, and it tells you something about how women would have been viewed in that culture at that time, and what sort of message was being given. But that is lost.
I do have sympathy with that. I really do, and I think there are many instances in which I think it would be good to not lose those things. So my hope is for something to do is to aim at linguistic translation, not cultural, but the two do touch each other, and there are moments in which I think you do have to do some cultural translation. And one of the things I have simply learned in this is that it's not about saying, you know, the ESV does this and the NIV does this or whatever, because all of them actually do lots of different things, and it's a case-by-case basis. What might work well in that instance where you say, no, let's keep the word woman for these reasons, because of this, in this context, the same choice you've made, you may choose to do something differently in a different passage. And this is what makes Bible translation so difficult, and so many factors impinge on it. We need to move on, just briefly on the reading for different things. Thank you for mentioning that, that's helpful. I do think this, hopefully your awareness of this means you'll think, okay, I may well want to turn to something like the ESV for more detailed study, because it is trying to be more formally equivalent to the text. My only caveat to that is that if we sort of think, oh, actually, I'll read the message just to sort of be hit by something, but the ESV if I want to do some decent study, I'm worried about both of those, because the message might not get it quite right. So I don't want to just... I don't want to sit loose to the text just because I want to be hit by something. And equivalently, as I've already said, more literal isn't always more accurate. So I'm cautious about that as well. But I do think having a range of translations and knowing what they're good at and bad at and then utilising them appropriately is a good thing. So I'm with you on the general principle. Let's move on, because we've got gender to do, and this could be huge, and we want to go home. So, in gender language, the big question is whether people are trying to be gender neutral, that is, a kind of philosophical approach that you say, I must include men and women. In my translation, I could never have something that just refers to men, because that's being, you know, sexist and biased and so on. So gender neutral as a kind of, you know, that's the way our culture is, so we must be gender neutral. As opposed to gender accurate. Sorry, Dirk. I've offended Dirk's sensibilities already. What I mean by gender accurate is that I reflect the genders or gender meant in the text. So, for example, Mark 13. The old NIV said, at that time, men will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with power and glory. And the reason it said men will see the Son of Man coming is because the word in Greek is often simply translated men. But it's a generic word that means men and women. Just like the word men 50 years ago meant men and women. It was used generically of all people. And so the ESV says that then they will see the Son of Man, just which doesn't changes it to a third person there, but it includes men and women. And the new NIV says, at that time, people will see. Now, nobody, as far as I'm aware, has any problem with that kind of change in language, because we can all see that that's being, in my perhaps horrible terms, more gender accurate than being gender neutral, trying to be sort of philosophically gender neutral. We know we're just being accurate, because we all know men and women are implied. And in today's culture, if you said, at that time, men will see, lots of people will probably think you mean men and women, and a fair number will probably think you mean men, as in males. because the word used to be generic, and I think we're in a time of transition where it either already isn't or it's becoming that it isn't generic at all. It depends on the groups you're talking to. Talking to the 50s, they'll think it's generic. Talk to a 20-year-old, they'll probably not think it is. Another example, Mark 1. Come, follow me, Jesus said, and I'll make you fishers of men. So I did this as a Bible story with my daughter some years ago, and because she was younger than she is now, we decided to act it out, and so we had our fishing rods, and we cast them out, and we wound them in, and I was making the point that actually we're fishing, but actually we're fishing for people. Isn't that weird, fishing for people? And my daughter turned to me and said, you're a man, I'll fish for you. And I thought, isn't that interesting? Because it didn't occur to me that this was about fishing for men, but that's how she heard it. At that point, I wasn't even thinking of that. And so the new NIV says, come follow me, I'll send you out to fish for people. Now, the big question is the use of generic terms today. I've just reintroduced the words men, but of course there's him and he, and so on. And so the question is how are those terms used in today's culture? It's worth just being aware that some languages never had a generic term to use at all for, it always had to choose between he or her. And so it could never have had a third person singular that was both male and female. English did. He was, you know, people would hear it as him and her. As I say, we're now entering a time, or we are in a time, depending on who you're talking to, when it's not heard like that. But some languages never even had that option. So it's not like something really weird is happening to us that we should be worried about. And the big question is how you think it's heard today. So the new NIV did a massive study on how English is used today. I can read you some bits and pieces if you're interested. But things like the word man, mankind, he, him. And then looked at the way people tended to express things, say that are singular, but expressing it in a way to encompass men and women. And you end up breaking the rules of grammar. So you end up with, if someone does this, they will. Now, that's singular in the first part of the sentence, it's someone, and it then becomes plural, they. So your English teacher should mark you down for that. It's grammatically incorrect. But actually, it is being used hugely in English all the time. So much so that for many people, it doesn't even sound odd. And it's actually quite a nice way of being able to refer to an individual and then not have to say someone does this, he will, and make it masculine. You can say they, which is generic. So they looked at all these things and ended up trying to develop a policy on what they're to do with specific gender terms. So here is a list of some examples of some of the areas that got impacted. Third person singular, the old NIV. Anyone hears my voice opens the roll, come and eat with him and he with me. They decided that they would try and avoid third person singulars being masculine in gender like that. So the new one, if anyone hears my voice, I will come in and eat with that person and they with me. Now I think that actually sounds slightly clumsy, that person doesn't read very well as far as I'm concerned. But they're avoiding the issue, and they're trying to keep it singular in the first part, so that you make it plural all the way through, then you end up, it ends up sounding like a group of people who hear his voice, whereas it is an individual who hears his voice. So we might, well, we may want to improve on it, we might not like it, but that's what they're doing with it. Generic use of man, Genesis 1, God created man in his own image. Now we obviously know that means male and female, because it's there as the verse goes on. They have changed that to God created mankind in his own image. Some earlier inclusive language editions had God created human beings, or humanity, or something like that, or people. They discovered in this big study they did that the word mankind still had a decent amount of currency, was still used a fair bit. And that's why they've used it in the 2011 version. Sons and children. Adoption in Galatians 4, this is, you receive the full rights of sons because of your sons. God sent the spirit of his son into your hearts, and so on. So you're no longer a slave but a son, and since you're a son, you're an heir. Right. Now, it happens, the receive full rights of sons was never a very good translation. The 2011 one, receive adoption to sonship, is actually a better rendering. And they've kept it as sons. Sonship, and because you are sons. And they've done it. Again, this shows that it's not a purely kind of gender neutral thing, because otherwise you wouldn't do that. They've done it because of the issue of the firstborn son and the son having rights over daughters and so on, and wanting to say actually all Christians have the position of son, like Jesus' son. But then as they go on, they say, so you're no longer a slave but God's child, and since you're his child, God's made you also an heir, as a way of trying to make it inclusive. Fathers, parents, I forget where this one's from. For 3 months he was cared for in his father's house. It's about Moses, isn't it? I think. Changed to parents' home, because the mother lived there as well. Is the father's house idiomatic for where you live? Or does it reflect in biblical culture the headship of the man? Now, to say that the use of the word father there necessarily involves headship, I think, isn't obvious. It could do.
Well, it could be one that, I mean, there are a lot of things the Bible does is assume something, I mean, we all do it, and it will just come out while we're talking about something completely different. So it could be that.
Yeah, it could do. My point is simply, it's about what you think the kind of connotations of father's house is that simply a way of referring to sort of idiomatically where your parents live, or does it actually reflect something about the role of father? So some people would accuse the new NIV here of bowing to kind of feminism and downplaying a complementary view of men, that men have a different role in the family. And I think that could be in that verse. I don't think it is necessarily in verses like that.
Isn't that basically the Eskimo problem? So the original didn't make it clear whether it's just a family or whether it's trying to assert the father's ownership of the house. But then when you translate it into English, you necessarily have to make that choice.
Yeah, kind of. It's more of an idiom problem than having lots of words you could use. But yeah, that's the issue. You either make father's house, which in English sounds odd. You might think, what if the parents split up? Because the father's house, where's the mother's house? Or you make it parents' home and you lose the idiom. So
it's one of the things that you haven't really mentioned, but one of the things that I've noticed as I've sort of looked at the issue of Bible translation is translations like the NIV, often there's disagreement amongst Christians as to what the phrase meant or what was implied. And because they want to sort of maximise how readable it is to someone who hasn't studied any of these issues, they make a decision for them. But that means that the reader then has closed off from them access to the possibility that the other way of reading it was the correct one. Well, the new NIV, actually, one of the ways in which it's been controversial is where there's a disagreement amongst evangelicals about how something was translated, they went one way. and included a footnote. But most of those footnotes have been, or a lot of those footnotes, have been removed in the new NIV. So again, one of the criticisms is, compared to the TNIV, which was perhaps more extreme, let's say, in the things that it did, it had more footnotes, so the reader at least knew that there was an alternate way of reading it or of rendering it.
Yeah. There is the issue of clothes. This now isn't to do with gender necessarily. This is a more general point. I agree. All translations have to close off options. There are lots of phrases in, say, in Greek, for example. I'll try to give an example. There's a phrase about, it has the word faith and it has the word Christ. And the way they're connected, it could be the faithfulness of Christ, or it could be faith in Christ. Now in Greek, you can have it just sitting there, and both are viable options. And in the context, so you have to decide which one it is. In English, there just isn't a way you can put it to allow both those options to exist. So you have to close it off. ESV does, everybody does. There are then some phrases which just could remain more ambiguous. Say, the obedience of faith. Is that the obedience of having faith? Or is that the obedience that comes from faith? And if I said, if you translated it, to obey by having faith, or something, or the obedience that comes from faith, then you would close off one of the options. Or if you just say the obedience of faith, both are there. We might think one's more natural than the other in English. But it sounds a bit ambiguous as you read it. Now, I agree with you. I think you want to be very careful about making decisions for the reader and closing off options. And in fact, the new NIV, on some of those sorts of examples, has made it more ambiguous and not closed it off as much as the old NIV did. But on some instances, it's closed it off more. And it's a case by case, which one is best here.
Clearly, I mean, all the things you've said, all translations have to do these sorts of things. It's just been, from what I've seen from my experience, is that the use the NIV and the ESV as examples. I'm not sure. The NIV is the centre of the spectrum as you presented it.
Yeah.
the NIV and the ESV both have to do this, but the NIV tends to do this sort of thing much more often.
Yeah. And I think that's right. And I think that's one reason why, in more careful study and so on, this morning, I read the ESV this morning for the passage I'm preaching on Sunday, having looked at it in the Greek already, but just because I wanted to look at different translations, I know the ESV is really helpful. So I'm agreeing with you. I just want to say it's not as simple as leaving everything open, because you can't.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And
all these things are a question of degree.
It's all a question of degree, and there's a question of then, say, readability and so on comes into play as well. And so it's where you're going to put yourself on the spectrum. But even when you put yourself roughly on a spectrum, you still make different decisions in different cases. So it's a mixture of where you put yourself on a big spectrum and then a case-by-case-by-case decision-making. Which is why it's very difficult to be so, to be making global comments about Bible versions.
Can I also just say, presumably, if we're talking about a Bible that we're using as a congregational version, then if you're reading out different versions and then preach on it, presumably that means you can then make us aware of where there are these issues. So
Yeah, and I think all of us who preach do that in different ways. We don't want to spend the time, you know, bombarding people with unhelpful detail. But if there are significant issues where we think a translation hasn't got it quite right, then we'll raise that.
Yeah.
Let me just back to the last couple of these and ask questions. Brothers and sisters, the word brother always meant and would have been heard as meaning sisters as well. So Paul often writes to, you know, the brothers so-and-so, and he meant the Christians there, including the girls. If your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault between the two of you, is the old NIV. So the new NIV says if your brother or sister sins, that happens, it's miss the against you, but don't, I'm not, that's not my point. It's just the brother or sister.
It introduces something kind of unwanted by effect here in IP 2011.
I know. And
so if sister sins against me, I am not going just between the two of us. I make sure I'm the third person with
me. Yes. But the principle of it not being about brothers, you know, is there. And then this has knock-on effects for not a huge amount, but has some effects on some what are called messianic texts. And Hebrews 2 is the classic. Hebrews 2 quotes Psalm 8. There is a place where someone has testified. This is Psalm 8. What is man that you are mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the angels. You crowned him with glory and honor, put everything under his feet. So that's a quote of Psalm 8 in Hebrews 2. And Hebrews 2 goes on to say, to talk about Jesus, and I think, well, everyone thinks, how Jesus is the ultimate fulfillment of that psalm, and how everything's been under the feet of Jesus. So what are you going to do with that? Because the what is man that you are mindful of him in Psalm 8, I think is about humanity in general. It's reflecting on Genesis 1 and how God has created humanity to have everything under their feet, to be rulers over the fish and the birds and so on. That's how Psalm 8 goes on. And the phrase son of man doesn't, in Psalm 8, have any kind of messianic prediction idea. It's simply the son of a person. It's a person. It's an idiom referring to another person, a human. And this is where our own Bible knowledge almost plays against us sometimes. In Daniel 7, which is where the Son of Man idea comes from that Jesus uses, Daniel 7 has lots and lots of creatures in it, weird animals. And then we read, I saw one that looked like a Son of Man come to the throne. And what we should hear in the first instance is, I saw a person, a human. But the phrase son of man is used. Now Jesus then uses the phrase son of man about himself. And he's picking up on Daniel 7, I think. But back in Daniel 7, you could translate Daniel 7, and I saw one that looked like a person or a human being. That would be a perfectly good translation of Daniel 7. But then we'd lose the kind of connections. So I'm spinning off.
There's Psalm 8 quoted.
There's one by that, right?
Yeah, this is being quoted in Hebrews 2. This is Hebrews 2 I put on here. So the new NIV has said, but there is a place where someone has testified, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? A son of man that you care for him. Now again, it hasn't gone for gender neutral, because it's put in the son of man bit. But it's pluralized the first bit, and then it makes it plural later. You made them a little lower and put everything under their feet. So it's trying to keep a kind of familiar biblical term that echoes things for us, son of man.
A bit tamey article.
He's son of man, rather than these son of man. Yes, although I think that, I'm trying to remember. I'd have to go back and have a look and see if the article is actually there. That may be. It's not there, thank you. I think that almost certainly was actually just a more accurate translation. And so they're trying to make it that it refers to humanity in general, but still has these echoes that could pick up referring to Jesus. It's a particularly difficult one to do well, because I honestly believe Psalm 8 is all about people in general. Lots of commentators think that this quote here is still in Hebrews 2 is about people in general, and it only becomes about Jesus later on. So my point on the gender thing is that it all turns on how you think generic terms are heard today, whether they will be heard as including men and women, or whether we've reached the stage where they're no longer heard like that. And if they're not heard like that, I don't think we really have any option but to translate them generically, translate in an inclusive way like this. And some of the accusations that are thrown at the NIV 2011 and the TNIV before it are that of just bowing to a kind of secular or feminist agenda or something like this. And I do think they are unwarranted. It's perfectly possible members of the translation committee are doing that. But as far as I can see, the translation choices they've made aren't doing that in and of themselves at all. It is all about how you think the language is heard and therefore what the best rendering is. As I mentioned earlier on, in some languages you had to do things like the right-hand column the very first time you translated it into that language, because they never had generic third-person singulars and that sort of thing anyway. That's what the debate is really over. Some of the language used makes it about being a feminist Bible and this sort of thing. I'm a complementarian in my view of the role of women, not an egalitarian, and I think it's a perfectly good translation. I think the translation choices are good ones. I'm not saying I agree with every one of them. I'd happily change lots of them. But with any translation, it's a choice of what you think is overall a good translation, not that you agree with every verse that's done. Let me stop there. We're a little bit late. Let's just give a couple of moments for questions and then we'll stop. And then if people have more questions, they can keep going with me and people can feel free to leave. So, questions on the gender stuff. Yeah.
So, the gender has some of the most aware it is a gender neutral option in the original, but a gender specific option is used, yet it's rendered gender neutral. So until, for example, in the Book of Proverbs,
yep.
The word son